George Rebus is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Rebus by injecting him with massive doses of drugs made to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Execution Watch host Otis McClain, legal analyst Robert Turner, criminal defense lawyer Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubek, Houston vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Sharon Silberstein, executive director of a group working to ban the death penalty in Connecticut and other states. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening, and what's normally scheduled at this time, Doyle? Is this it's Michio Kaku?
No, it's Uprising.
Uprising, Sonali Kohatkar's weekly wrap-up will not be heard tonight because we have an execution in Texas, and our deal is that whenever we have an execution, we do Execution Watch, not my favorite show. And with us tonight, we have... I can remember these names. I'm not Ray Hill. You probably noticed that. My name's Otis McClay, and tonight we have with us Larry Douglas, and we have Robert Turner. And Jim Skelton is on assignment or something. I don't know what that was. And tonight the state of Texas is going to execute George Rebus. George Rebus was the so-called leader of the jailbreak that happened, first jailbreak in Texas from a maximum security prison. And that was, what, 2 years ago?
Back in 2000.
Yeah, in 2000. So it was, that long ago? Boy, time flies. So, and all of the participants in that ended up getting the death penalty, as far as I know, because of the Texas law of parties, which means if you participate, correct me if I'm wrong, if you participate in any kind of any group that commits a capital crime, anyone in that group who does it, everybody gets the same penalty, basically.
Well, everyone is subject to the same penalty. In a death penalty case, there is only two possible punishments, death and life. And back when they tried this case, all seven of the participants were given death.
All right. Let's see. With us, we have Professor Longmire is in Huntsville.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello. I wish I could say it's good to be here.
Yeah.
It's never good to be here. Literally at the top of the show, as you began speaking, the witnesses proceeded across the street, which is the signal to us on the corner, letting us know that the execution is actively underway. Mr. Rebus has already been strapped to the gurney and made ready. And so my suspicion is that this is going to be a very expeditious killing that we're going to go through this evening.
Now, of course, he gave TDCJ a black eye by, being able to get out.
Well, and that's part of the problem. One of the things right now, for example, I can see just beyond the horizon of the hill I'm looking at, probably two dozen police officers, all of them here, obviously mourning for the loss of one of their brothers and their fellow officers. But we have to not just simply place the blame on Rebus and his crew, because CDC let everyone down when these guys got out. This should never have happened.
Right. Right. Are there anybody in the protesting crowd?
Well, I'm in this group. There are four or five of us right now, and most of us are regulars. All of us are regulars. We're not here because of this particular execution, but all executions,
right,
and we oppose all of them. For me, as a professor of criminal justice, it's always harder to be here when the victim is a servant of justice. And
right.
so it's a very heavy, heavy-hearted night for me on a lot of levels.
All right. Dennis Longmire at Huntsville at the Walls Unit. And I guess you will call Elizabeth when they come out.
Yes, I certainly will.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Later. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire. He's at Huntsville. And, of course, this execution is taking place. There is no stay. There is no answer. And George Rivas actually was saying he really kind of wanted to go, didn't he? I saw some of that. And Larry?
Yeah, he did. Just a couple of things, Otis. Under the law of parties, as you mentioned before, that applies not just to death penalty cases, but to all cases.
Okay.
Participants can be subject to the same kind of charges and punishment.
But anybody who was tried under this law of parties would still be, they would still have to go through the punishment phase and answer the three questions and so forth for each of the individuals?
No, those special issues would apply just to death penalty cases.
Okay.
But in all criminal cases, the law of parties would apply. The other thing is one of the escapees, Larry Harper, actually committed suicide before he was captured. But the surviving ones, they all did receive the death penalty, but were all sentenced to execution. And Michael Rodriguez, who waived all appeals, was executed a couple of years ago. But people remember this case, probably a lot of them. I think this was dubbed the Texas Seven back during the time that they escaped, and this is near the Christmas time, back in 2000. So they were actually on the lam or free for several weeks, during which time they committed several offenses, the last being the Oshman Sporting Goods store, aggravated robbery, and then finally the murder of Officer Hawkins back on Christmas Eve back in 2000. And that led to the death penalty for all of them.
Dad, did we have a rundown on the case that we were going to take a look at, Robert? I'm not sure what the plan was.
Well, the case that went to trial, and all seven of the cases were tried in separate courts at separate times because they're death penalty cases, so you don't try them together. And I don't know what order each of the captured inmates were tried, but seven juries gave death penalty verdicts to all of the inmates. I mean, they were all substantially doing, I mean, like Rivas, who's being executed tonight, was doing 17 life sentences at the age of 30. So he was pretty much without any type of hope that he would ever going to be paroled with any life left. And I think almost everybody else had significant sentences for significant crimes that they committed.
You're listening to Robert Turner, and Robert Turner and Larry Johnson are here. I'm Otis McClay, sitting in for Ray Hill, who is running for office. So, and tonight we are witnessing the execution of George Rivas, who was the leader of this and the planner of the escape. And some of the stuff I read said that he was very good at that. He was very good at planning it.
He appeared to be pretty good and apparently pretty experienced at having done this before. Actually, the gentleman we're talking about tonight, George Rivas, was serving, as Robert has mentioned, 17 life sentences.
And what was that for?
Included 13 counts of aggravated kidnapping with a deadly weapon, 4 counts of aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon, 1 count of burglary with a habitation. He and 6 other inmates escaped from the TDCJ, and after their escape, they committed several robberies, including robbing the sporting goods store, the Oshman store, in Irving, Texas, at gunpoint. And an Irving police officer was murdered at the time.
All right. Thank you, Larry. All kinds of things. Hi, Dave Atwood. Hey.
Hello.
Where are you?
Hey, we're out on the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd by St. Anne's Catholic
Church. By St. Anne's?
Right.
Okay, and what's happening?
Well,
give me a full description.
Large group today. We've got a small group, only about four people, but they're the steady people that always come out for these protests. And the good thing about this corner is that, again, we have literally hundreds and hundreds of cars go by.
Right.
And they see our signs. And I think today we have had a number of people that acknowledged, you know, gave us a thumbs up. I don't think we had one person go by today that gave us a thumbs down or said anything negative, which is shows how I think the people of Houston are changing on this subject. I think more and more people are coming against the death penalty. And in the survey that Steve Feinberg does out of Rice University confirms that more people in his survey, which basically covers Harris County, want to have a long prison sentence rather than the death penalty. So people are changing, and I think our being out here helps with that whole process.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're doing the hard work.
Yeah, we kind of eat a few gas fumes out here when we do it. But, you know, we have two people here, Burnham Terrell and his wife Joan, who have been doing this for years. They're both in their 80s. What's that tell you about activism? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, no, that's
impressive.
Yeah,
I mean, they're fantastic people.
All right, so Dave Atwood is at the corner of right in front of St. Anne's Church there on Westheimer Shepherd, right?
Right, right. So
go by and flash your lights.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Thank you for what you're doing.
You take care.
Okay.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, there's some consciousness out there.
Otis, Larry and I were talking before the show started, and the difficult thing about this particular set of cases or this particular case is that you have individuals that were already doing substantial sentences, no hope for any type of freedom in the near future, and they, you know, put themselves and other people in danger by breaking out. They went on a robbery spree, ended up costing a young police officer his life. And so it was very difficult for the defense attorneys in all of the cases to get up to the jury when they're arguing lack of future dangerousness on behalf of any of these individuals, especially with George, because you were asking about Rivas. He gave a 21-page confession when he was captured in Colorado, and he detailed exactly how they planned it, what they did. He had total recall of it, and this was an intelligent human being that, for all practical purposes, under different circumstances, might have ended up, you know, in a different place at a different time. But it was hard for the defense lawyers to argue, and you could see that the jury almost, they could just phone in the verdict in these cases. So
just makes it tough.
It does.
But, I mean, you know, we're talking about people who essentially don't play well with others.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm, you know, I mean, that's how I put it. And not people who would probably be reintegrated into society. That's my guess.
Right.
And so we don't really have a way of dealing with that in a humane way.
We don't, because we had the death penalty. I mean, for a long time in Texas, it was either your choices for a jury was the death penalty or life in prison. And we were not allowed. For the death penalty came back into, for all practical purposes, in effect after Witherspoon, which was a Supreme Court decision in 1974, that said under certain circumstances, if certain states want to have the death penalty, they have to follow this set of criteria, this set of procedures, this set of laws. So as Texas started prosecuting people for death penalty cases, the juries were given that life or death choice at the end of the case, and at that time we were...
Well, it's sort of abstract because it's those three questions, future danger, I can't remember all of the...
Well, it was future dangerousness, and was the crime committed intentionally? Well, of course it was, because they got him there. But the problem the juries were having was is we as defense lawyers were not allowed to comment on the length of time that a life sentence meant at that time in the state of Texas. But that often the prosecutors would infer either subtly or tacitly that, you know, this person would be probably paroled in 12 or 13 years. And because we were seeing things in the paper that were reported that were virtually untrue about the length of time that an inmate might serve on a life sentence. So the juries were thinking, if we don't give the guy a death penalty, he's going to be back on the streets. He's going to reoffend. So for a long time, that was what we were operating under. Then finally, the Court of Criminal Appeals said, after 25 years, okay, you can tell them a little bit more about what a life sentence means. And then we finally did away with all of that, and they established a what they call a non-death penalty, life without parole type of thing. And we're finding that I think only in the last, maybe in the last year, calendar year, only five people have been assessed the death penalty in Harris County, which traditionally had been... and still is the largest county to return death penalty verdicts in the state of Texas.
Still?
Yeah.
Even after?
Surpasses Dallas, San Antonio, and all of them.
Yeah. Right. What else can we say about this? I mean, we talk about the breakdown in society, inability to deal with people who are sociopaths without having to go through the criminal justice system. They have to obviously do something. We don't really, even though there's some stuff in the prison world now about a test that Canadian guys at McGill invented to determine if somebody's a sociopath, as they're starting to use that now. But I don't know how we deal with this kind of a thing other than this, you know, pretty much antediluvian approach.
Well,
I mean, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, Larry and I are lawyers, and we deal with facts, and we deal with after the system has already accused this person of misconduct or wrongdoing or, you know, sometimes horrible crimes that are very hard to even justify, explain, mitigate, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But, you know, we all like to think that if things and programs and safety nets were in effect a long time ago, then Larry's job and my job would either be different or we'd be, you know, trying personal injury cases or doing other matters because, you know, maybe we would not have the type of problems that we have. So, you know, it's hard to say how far it goes back.
Say something, Doyle. Well, that was the, you know, I said sociopath, and Doyle, who's engineering the show, just asked me, is there any evidence that he was a sociopath? But I think, you know, 17 life sentences suggest that he doesn't really, as I put it, doesn't play well with others. I mean, kidnapping people is kind of scary.
Well, the issues are more targeted than just the determination of someone is a sociopath. One, did he commit a deliberate act where he's already been found guilty of intentionally murdering someone? The future dangerousness, okay, and then the issue of mitigation. Those are the three basic issues that are used to determine whether you give a person the death penalty or not. In Revis's case, when you look at the facts of the case, he was already serving 17 life sentences. He escaped from prison on the 11th of December, and on Christmas Eve, he, after having committed some other offenses, he and the other six inmates orchestrate the robbery of the Oshman store. And it was done with some degree of planning.
Yeah, it was carefully planned.
That is, pretending to be a security officer, saying that they were investigating a theft at another Oshman. One guy on the outside, the other two guys pretend to be security officers, go to the management and say, we're investigating, get all of your employees together to look at a photo spread. Get them all in the break room and then pull a gun on them. And while the others are cleaning out the store, and these this group manages to take a car, escape with over $70,000 in cash, 44 firearms, ammunitions, and other goods from the store. They robbed the employees of their jewelry, and then ended up not only killing the officer, the first responder to the scene, who was actually shot multiple times, shot 11 times in a period of just a few minutes and pretty much died instantly, pull his lifeless body out of the car, and then somehow he gets run over by the car that Rivas is driving. So when the jury looks at this...
So Rivas was claiming that he shot him in the chest because he was wearing a flak jacket.
Right.
Rivas says
but
he
the other guys...
that.
Didn't participate in that.
There were
that's
several
a mitigating
shots.
Circumstance for Rivas that he didn't really try to kill him,
and that he didn't really mean to run over him. Yeah. He didn't know that he was dragging the guy.
It was an accident because there was somebody waiting. The girlfriend of one of the workers,
right.
Is that right? Was waiting outside, and she called 911.
She saw something suspicious.
Yeah.
Called 911.
That's why Hawkins showed up.
Four or five police officers responded, but he was first to the scene, first out of the car.
Just as they were
going out the back and loading everything up. I mean, Rivas, in a way, is almost a poster child for our pro-death penalty advocates because of, you know, his prior record and because there's a police officer involved here and because of the, you know, of the way the murder during the course of a robbery, et cetera, et cetera. I think that what is lost is that a lot of people were tried in the 70s and the 80s and 90s, and maybe some jurisdictions still to this day, that had they been at a different geographic location where they're prosecuted, or if they were
been
prosecuted
rich.
In a different venue, or had more money for a better lawyer or better resources, or perhaps over were a different race.
I was going to say a different color, right.
Different intellect. That they would not have been assessed, or indeed the prosecution would not have even chose to prosecute for a death penalty and go just what they call a non-death penalty capital murder case. Rivas and the co-defendants, almost like I said, the jury could have phoned this one in.
But I have to ask the question, you have somebody like Rivas, I guess he was really crazy about being locked up. I mean, apparently this was a major issue with him. But you look at somebody intelligent like that, and you wonder if there's a way they could contribute in prison, even if it was a life sentence. I mean, there are people who have done that. I mean, we have seen the Shawshank Redemption. You know, maybe we've read Carol Chessman's books. And it just seems like a waste. And the other question I was going to ask, well, how much did these trials cost? And this whole process of seven death penalty cases must have been moderately expensive.
They estimate
like
that the average cost of a capital murder, prosecution, appeals, and et cetera, could be anywhere from a $500,000 to $2 million to $2.5 million.
Yeah, depending on, yeah.
So you times that by another six, you know, you're talking about substantial resources that could have been spent otherwise.
Okay, we have, let's see, Dennis Longmire.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello. I am sad to report that the witnesses have just begun to leave the Walls unit. One of the reporters, who's a very frequent reporter, always manages to position himself in the witness chamber for the family of the victims because they actually get released from the prison first.
Is that
so
Mike?
I saw him come out, and so the execution is over, and I suspect that you'll be hearing more on the news real soon.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for being there and doing the work that you're doing.
Well, and, I wish that I had something else and someplace else to be, as you well know.
Right.
But thank you for the work that you guys do and for calling attention to this particular event. It's not something I think that we should be proud of. No matter which side of this issue you're on, we've just taken another person's life, and we need to be somber and respectful of that.
In our name.
In our name, exactly.
Yeah, as though we had done it, yes. Dennis Longmire, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
No. Yeah, well, once again, in my name. And I guess I should point out that after, was it after Witherspoon? When the states were reestablishing the death penalty, every time a state reestablished the death penalty, and I don't know how many there were, how many are now, 17 or something.
I think that's right.
It's something like that. Every time they did it, the rate of violent crime went up in the state. And it raises the question of something that I think, you know, I have no proof for this, but to me, the culture comes from the top. And, you know, if parents control their children physically, then the kids learn that that's how you do it. And if the state determines that the way to solve problems is to kill people, that filters down. People look at that as a means to solve problems. I mean, I hate to think what's going on in Syria right now, that we have a state that thinks the way to solve the problem is to just kill a whole bunch of people.
Well, I think one of the ways that, you know, education sometimes on this particular issue, because of it's such a highly emotional issue, and because a lot of people haven't thought it through a lot of people don't walk around thinking about the death penalty and what their feelings are about it, unless you either were affected by it one way or the other, or sat on a death penalty, or had a loved one, you know, killed, or had a loved one prosecuted. So I think what it really gets down to is educating people. And also, every now and then, when you see governors of certain states come out and throw their hands up and say, you know, because of the Innocence Project, and they have shown that we have executed innocent people, maybe...
George Ryan of Illinois.
Absolutely. And there are other states that have declared moratoriums on the death penalty, or refuse to execute any more people until they're absolutely 100% sure. So there's different.
But I think there are also states that have looked at, I'm thinking maybe it was Kansas or Nebraska, looking at getting rid of the death penalty just because it's so incredibly expensive.
Well, I think economics, especially,
we don't have the money for that luxury anymore.
They don't. I mean, in a little town, Austin County, right up the road, they have presently pending 5 capital murder prosecutions. 4 of them arose out of one transaction a couple of years ago. There was a doctor and his young wife and child were attacked by some farm workers. And he was shot. It was a robbery gone bad where he had hired somebody out of Houston, and they brought their family along, and they were going to rob this guy. And then there was another crazy guy that wiped out his family. And all of those prosecutions, the defense lawyers were able to convince, and probably county commissioner's court, the lead prosecutor up there is a guy named Travis Keene, to not try these as death penalty cases, because I think economics was one of the main issues in the case.
The county has to pay for it, right?
They do, except in prison breakouts. Now, in prison breakouts, there's special legislation that was passed a long time ago for not only prison breakouts, but in prison cases where prisoners commit violent acts against either guards or other prisoners, and they're prosecuted, that they can apply, and the legislature has appropriated a certain amount of money that can supplement the counties for those prosecutions, especially places that have prison units. So I suspect that the defense and some of the costs of prosecution were borne by the state of Texas in these capital murder cases. But that is, economics does play a part, and will, I think, play a bigger part.
I that seems to be it. And in fact, in the times that I've dealt with it have always raised that issue, the economic issue, but it doesn't seem to have a lot of traction because I guess revenge feels so good. Somehow you feel justified. And of course, no politician is going to run soft on crime.
Right.
You know, but it, we still have the drug war going
Another way to sell it to somebody that is pro-death penalty that hadn't maybe done a lot of thinking about it is the fact that ever since Witherspoon and the states did start applying the death penalty again, those states that did have the death penalty, you know, I think something less than 1,000 people have been executed. So if you think in terms of all of the homicides that have occurred are all of the brutal slayings and things that have occurred where people either negotiated or were in states that where they could not assess the death penalty, or it was in federal court and it didn't qualify for one of the death penalty type crimes. So, you know, the fact that it's such selective prosecution might have some bearing on changing people's minds if you can educate them.
And what's being done? I mean, it's just such a, so much of our political and cultural discourse is ruled by Fox News, by people who are not giving information but speaking in order to, you know, their hidden agendas get elected.
But a lot of things are being done, but when you look at how effective will it be? Now, these cases, to me, raise the issue of how effective is the life without parole. It's gonna be very good in a whole lot of cases, but in a case like this, these seem to be almost poster boys.
And emotional
for the life without parole, because what could you do with them? They had no chance of getting out of prison, and while they were serving life sentences, for instance, Revis had been implicated in more than a dozen aggravated robberies since 1987, and he pleaded with the jury to give him the death penalty. He told the jury, I don't want to just exist anymore like an animal in prison. And if a person is in prison who has nothing to lose, and they get desperate, as they might get in a situation of life without parole, that very well might cause the solution might not, and that's a good solution in a lot of cases, but not necessarily in every single case.
But many of the wardens in Texas were kind of upset when they got rid of Goodtime because they had no way to, there was, all you had was punishment. You didn't have any reward. There was
You've
no
gotta have
way
a reward. Yeah.
To control it. And, you know, because politicians are so busy running against crime that they think getting tough on crime works. And, of course, if it worked, then we wouldn't have any, right? Because we're plenty tough, in fact. We have on the line with us, we have Sherry Silberstein. She's the executive director of Equal Justice USA. And she was a key member of teams that repealed the death penalty in New Jersey in 2007 and ended the death penalty in New York in 2005 and gutted Maryland's death penalty in 2009. National grassroots organization working to build a criminal justice system that is, geez, fair and effective and humane. Sherry, that sounds revolutionary.
Thank you. We're doing what we can.
Can you get away with that?
We're going to try.
I mean,
surprisingly, a lot of people want their criminal justice system to be effective, so we think we're on the right side of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many hidden agendas in the whole process of prosecution and so forth that you know, I wonder how much of it is actually dealing with the issue of crime and resolving that. Maybe reducing the amount of crime that we have. I don't know. Tell me more about...
Yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, our a lot of our focus right now is on the death penalty, as you know. But we do have kind of a broader vision for the criminal justice system and the idea that, you know, the system is really supposed to work. That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to prevent crime. It's supposed to reduce violence. It's supposed to help people rebuild their lives in the aftermath of crime, and, you know, help people cope with the trauma in the aftermath of crime and create opportunities so that people don't return to crime and we don't have repeat offenders. And a lot of the emphasis right now is on sort of after the fact. Once the crime has occurred, how do we get tough? How do we mop up the mess by warehousing people? But at that point, it's already too late. I mean, being tough on crime after the fact has already kind of missed the boat, because you already have another victim and you have another, you know, example of violence and trauma. So what we're saying is, let's stop that cycle in the first place, because as we know, it doesn't really work. And the death penalty, in a lot of ways, is not just a microcosm of that problem, but it's actually a very severe concentration of all of those issues. You know, it takes millions and millions of dollars concentrated on a handful of cases, where most murders don't result in the death penalty, even in Texas, but certainly not in other parts of the country, and concentrates all these millions of dollars and years and years and years and decades and all of the state's energy on, you know, one or two cases after the murder has already been committed. Meanwhile, there's hundreds and thousands of crime survivors or victims' families who have all these unmet needs, have not gotten any help to cope with their trauma, you know, not emphasize reducing violence and crime prevention. And it's sort of a skewed system that seems more about symbolism than about actually accomplishing anything.
Yeah. Were you going to say something, Larry?
Well, the only thing I wanted to say was that we talk about the criminal justice system, and whatever the solution we end up with, it's got to go through the court system. And the courts are naturally reactionary. After something happens, then the person has to go to court. Now, there has to be an all-out approach to correcting the problem. But when it comes to the court system, it's got to be done in accordance with the laws. To eliminate the death penalty, though, you almost have to step away from the facts of the gory facts of a case and just decide, like some counties have, we're just not gonna do it because it's too expensive, because it's not reliable, because we make mistakes, because we execute the wrong people. You almost have to do it, step away from the facts of the gory cases. And make the philosophical decision as to whether a civilized society should really be ever engaged in the business of killing its own citizens. And once we get it to that level, then it's just a matter, once we close that off, then it's a matter, what do we do after that?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Sherry, what kind of a vision? You must have some kind of a vision of how you would change or, you know, modify the criminal justice system, or things that you would want to see that aren't there, or things, you know, that are there that you would like to not see.
Sure. Well, I mean, just going back to the previous statement about the death penalty, and I don't think it actually has to be about philosophy. In our view, the death penalty, just on a practical level, is a failure. And even many people who philosophically support it and think it's okay for a civilized society to be in the business of killing people have practically come to believe that all of these reasons that it's broken cannot be fixed.
Well, when you say failure, you mean that it doesn't prevent people killing other people.
Well, not only does
the advertised reason
people,
for
but it,
it
also risks executing an innocent person. It also sucks up tons of dollars and resources. It also puts victims' family members through a very prolonged process that's painful and re-traumatizing. You know, it is also applied in a very uneven and arbitrary manner. You can't really define the worst of the worst, since it's really isolated to a very small number of counties in the U.S. Not even just states, but counties. You know, the vast majority of the United States, and even the majority of Texans, live in places without the death penalty. They don't use it. So it has all of these risks and flaws and problems, and at the same time doesn't actually accomplish anything. So it's sort of a failure in every category.
You mean, when you say accomplish anything, you mean it doesn't reduce murder in society?
It does not, right.
It does not.
It's It's not a deterrent.
Well, see, I have to raise the issue of whether punishment is a deterrent myself, because I actually don't believe in punishment. But then, you know, that's me. I mean, I don't think it's useful. I don't think it's a useful tool. Most of the things that happen, and I think we know most of the people who do things that are against the law or that are socially not nice justify it in their own heads when they do it.
Well, and most people don't believe that they're ever.
But the other thing is murder has a very low recidivism rate. When people serve time for murder and get out, they're much less likely to go back than people who break and enter. I think that was a statistic that I saw once.
Well, I mean, the other thing that's true is, you know, within prisons, I think the question came up earlier on your show about sort of violence within prisons. And, you know, it is really those lower level crimes and people who have been in for a short amount of time that are more likely to commit violence in prison. And the long termers, the lifers, the people who've committed murder and have been there for 20 and 30 years are usually not the troublemakers.
There's also an issue about getting older.
Exactly. And that there's a recognition that they're going to be there for a long time, and they've sort of adjusted to prison life, and they have to make the best of it. But to go back to your earlier question about sort of the broader, you know, it's clear the death penalty needs to kind of get out of the way. It sort of sucks up all the air in the room and really doesn't leave open a space for more meaningful conversation about how you deal with crime. But once that's out of the way, you know, what we'd like to see is, first of all, to not define the criminal justice system so narrowly as just the court system. Because I think your other guest is right. The court system is reactionary, and it's about what do we do after a crime has occurred. But there's a whole other system, a public safety system that includes law enforcement and that includes victim services and other things where we'd like to see that the majority of the emphasis is on preventing crimes before they occur, and that when they do occur, in those cases where we haven't been able to prevent it, that there's really meaningful efforts to help people rebuild their lives, and that's both on the victim side, because victims face incredible amount of trauma in the aftermath of crime, and most of them have no access to, you know, any kind of counseling or financial support, you know, somebody to change the locks or to, you know, stand with them during the lineup and coach them through what they're going to be going through in the court system. And those traumas get sort of embedded in them. And, you know, a lot of people who commit crimes at some point earlier in their lives were actually victimized, you know, the victim of a crime, and their trauma was left unattended to. So if we could sort of intervene at the point of victimization, help people rebuild their lives, break the cycle, and then, you know, reduce crime that way, give people who do commit crimes, help them to find opportunities so that they don't commit, you know, reoffend, and reduce recidivism that way, I think that people will find, whether you believe in punishment or not, I think you'll find that there are a lot fewer people to be punished in the first place.
Yeah, do you have a response, Larry?
I guess my concern in terms of the criminal justice system, well, the court system, we can't overlook, just have to admit that vengeance is an extremely powerful factor in the court system itself, and when you include the victims in the process, their concerns would be when the number of police officers who show up at an execution and those kind of things for a cop killer, where the widows and so forth make victim impact statements.
Where the police show up and sit in court during the trial. And the wives sit there in the trial and look at the jury.
That push
has been done.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's part of what pushes the punitive aspect of the court system, and particularly as it relates to the death penalty cases. When you look at the cases individually, like George Rivas today, and it's hard to the strong feeling about a person who has 17 life sentences, and who assaults and threatens prison employees during the escape because at 30 years old, fairly young man, he has decided that I don't want to spend the pretty much the balance of my life in prison, so I have nothing to lose. Society, the vengeful people in our society feel like we need to be protected from that, including the employees of the prison and then those on the outside who might be their victims should they escape.
Sherry, anything?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, it's really important to understand that victims have significant needs that have nothing to do with the court system or what happens to the offender. I mean, just this morning, actually, there was a press conference in Connecticut, which is considering repealing the death penalty this year. They're going to be taking up the bill soon. And there was a press conference this morning where a group of family members who'd all lost close loved ones to homicide presented a letter signed by 179 victims' family members, and that's almost 200 families, calling for repeal of the death penalty and speaking out about how the death penalty has harmed them as crime victims in the state. And, you know, by focusing so many millions of dollars on a couple of cases when all of them across the state have these unmet needs. There was a speaker who talked about how her children, you know, before the murder of her son, her children were ambitious and they were successful at school, and her son was murdered a few years ago. They got absolutely no help. They, you know, barely got any attention. As an African-American family, and that's one of the issues, is that, you know, the way that victims are treated is very different depending on the race and the class and the social status, social economic status. And now her same, those same children are not doing well in school, and they're kind of falling apart, and she's a mess. And, you know, a very brave woman who came to speak out and has incredible needs, and an intervention is clearly needed so that the rest of these kids don't sort of end up going in the wrong direction, and it's just not there. And, you know, this is has to be part of what's factored into our justice system. You know, it's not the court system, but it is related to crime and the aftermath of crime. These needs need to be taken care of. And the death penalty, frankly, is diverting all this attention and resources on a couple of cases and ignoring all of this other stuff that actually has much greater impact on all of us and our public safety and what happens next.
Yeah, that's actually, that's kind of interesting. I had never thought of that. You're listening to Execution Watch. Ray Hill is off. I'm Otis McClay. I'm here with Robert Turner and Larry Douglas. And on the phone is Sherry Silberstein, who is the executive director of Equal Justice USA. There, I remembered to run it down again. I usually forget that. That's interesting, the idea of so much of the resources, assuming it's a zero-sum game, that the resources that could be going to things that Sherry is talking about, dealing with victims and some of the fallout from crimes and, you know, going to this grandstanding death penalty thing, which I guess is what, to a great extent, what prosecutors run on.
Well, and what really happens when you have a death penalty is, you know, both legally and just logistically, it's not feasible to apply the death penalty in all murder cases. Everybody knows it's supposed to be so-called reserved for the worst of the worst. But first of all, what does that mean? I mean, to anybody whose child has been murdered, it's the worst crime that's ever happened. So you immediately start off by creating this hierarchy of victims where most victims are told your crime is actually not heinous enough and your loved one murder was not heinous enough, not worthy of the death penalty. And so you're starting off kind of narrowing the field right from the beginning to a small number of cases. So those people, for those victims that do get the death penalty, even when they want it, what they find is that it turns out to be a life sentence for them because they're going back to court 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 20 years down the road, promised you will feel better when there's an execution. And in most of those cases, I mean, two-thirds of death sentences are reversed at some point because of, you know, some kind of error. And a lot of them are not reinstated. So here, victims have been given this promise. 15 years later, the sentence is reversed. It ends up in a life sentence that they could have had from the get-go, and the sentence would have just begun immediately. Instead, they're left in limbo. They don't begin their healing process. that's for the, you know, those victims where the death penalty is handed down. And for the vast majority, you know, they're sort of left to feel like their crime isn't really that important. And then nobody kind of gets any of the help that they really need. So in every direction, it's really failing the victims' families, which is who we often say it's for.
Robert?
Sherry, just an observation. This is Robert. I've tried a lot of cases. I've tried a couple of death penalty cases. And, you know, when you're just trying non-death penalty cases and the judge or prosecutor will ask the veneer panel, the panel of people that you're picking a jury from, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your view on punishment, rehabilitation, deterrence, or the punitive aspect on revenge? If it's not a crime of violence that you're trying, you know, some of your potential jurors will, you know, give some credence to the idea that prison is, you know, for rehabilitation, but primarily they'll say deterrence. Obviously, with the death penalty, I think even the almost everybody will agree that, of course, rehabilitation's out of the window because of the nature of the punishment. But the deterrent factor is small or none, because most people that commit, unless it's very calculated crime involving, you know, murder for hire, insurance schemes, or things like that, most crimes of violence are not well thought out, not well planned, and usually the result of a mistake or some type of panicking on the part of someone, either the victim or the perpetrator. So it really gets down to revenge. And I think what you're saying is let's take these resources that we spend in getting our revenge, teaching the victim not to seek revenge, but to seek some type of closure before this long, sometimes odyssey of 20 or 30 years, certainly in Rivas's case here tonight, 12 years, and he actually got on the stand and asked for the death penalty. He didn't waive his appeals. But to use those resources in educating the other people that come in contact before perhaps the prosecution even incurs, of what their expectations are, and maybe helping them heal so that they're not so much in seeking revenge but in seeking some other type of satisfaction or closure for what particular horrible situation has happened to them or their family.
Yeah, I would have to say that somebody sold them revenge as a way of resolving their issue, and unfortunately it rarely does. Sherry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things that I want to say here. I mean, one is I don't want to profess to be either speaking, you know, telling victims how they should feel or teaching them what they're supposed to feel. This is what I'm saying is not something that I came up with. It's something that I've learned from the hundreds of victims' family members that I've worked with, who have, you know, come to us and said, this is not working for us, and this is actually what we need. And I would say that many of those families are not necessarily saying we'd rather have services and therefore we don't want revenge. I think it's, you know, the day-to-day needs that they have are just a reality, and, you know, it's not necessarily one or the other. But it is true that for not only for victims but for all of us, revenge is sort of all that we know. And it's a very human and natural instinct. And I don't think we would be well served to kind of approach any criminal justice policy by pretending that we can sort of teach it away. But if we were to kind of put in place other mechanisms by which people can work through their trauma and their grief, you know, what we've seen just in practice is that people feel differently at the end of those processes.
Did you have something, Larry? Okay, I was going to say, Sherry, I want to, this is what you do with Equal Justice USA, I'm guessing, and website.
Yes, ejusa.org.
It's what is it?
Part of what we do. I mean, a lot of the work that we do.
EJUSA. EJUSA.org, okay.
EJUSA.org. And people can go there. They can sign up for our mailing list. You can take action and write to your lawmakers and ask them to repeal the death penalty, anything you want to do.
Great. All right. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we will talk again.
All right.
We've got about 5 minutes to wrap up. What did we learn?
Well, I think one thing that we learned is that the state of Texas is still going to go forward with executions of at least some of the more notable cases that even the Supreme Court of the United States or the Fifth Circuit, the parole board, obviously are not going to stop. So at some point in time, as the number of prosecutions, and I'm seeing this down at the courthouse, the number of prosecutions for death penalty has fallen since we've gotten life without parole. I mean, it might be a good thing, a bad thing, depending on your point of view.
But we also have a different DA.
That's correct. We do. We do have a different DA, a different philosophy. There's no longer that sort of that George Bush swagger type of philosophy that we saw during the exactly. And so you're going to see less executions as a result of that. But what you're seeing now is you're filtering cases from the late 90s, the early 2000s, that are just now reaching the stages where the second and third rounds of writs and appeals and, you know, so you're going to see some executions. And I don't know how you stop that. Even if you have a different philosophy on what your prosecution theory is now, whether or not you'll see people stepping up to the plate and actually recommending to the Board of Parole and Pardons, you know, the clemency petitions that are being filed, you know, whether or not you'll have a governor that's willing to consider, you know, commutations and things of that nature. I mean, only time will tell on that.
Larry, anything?
Yeah, I'm just encouraged by the fact, as Robert points out, that the numbers of death penalty cases are declining. The law doesn't provide for a remedy to every single wrong, whether it's a criminal matter or a civil matter. There are just so many limitations that we are constricted by. If a person commits a crime, prosecutor takes it to court, and there are limits to what we can do, but the overall solution does rest in society.
Yeah, and I think my own personal opinion, I'm sorry, Doyle, I didn't hear that. Say it. Oh, end at 58? I have to end at 58, so that means we have one more minute. So I got one more minute to not rant. I just want to say, I'm Otis McClay sitting in for Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch, which we do whenever Texas honors us with another killing of another one of our citizens, no matter who they are. Next Wednesday, March 7th, there is another execution, Keith Stephen Thurmond. And so we will be back then with doing this again. And it just doesn't seem to stop. But maybe by raising the consciousness and the issue, we can just move forward to kind of a humane and a more intelligent criminal justice system, which actually does something to stop crime instead of keeping it going so that people can be reelected. There's my cynical take on this. And stay tuned for Arab Voices. Saeed is here. And this is KPFT Houston.